Support for WGTD's morning show comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. WGTD is also supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's morning show, we are previewing for you a powerful documentary that airs tonight on the PBS series American Experience. The film is called Klansville, USA. It charts the, in some respects, expected and yet unexpected resurgence in the state of North Carolina of the Ku Klux Klan in the late 1950s and through the 1960s at the height of the Civil War era. It was surprising that it occurred in North Carolina because North Carolina was widely regarded, and with good reason, as perhaps the most progressively minded of the states in the South. And yet that is where the Ku Klux Klan grew in spectacular fashion. And this documentary charts that and explores some of the reasons why. Much of the documentary is based on a book called Klansville, USA, The Rise and Fall of the Civil Rights Era Ku Klux Klan, by David Cunningham, a professor of sociology at Brandeis University. I asked Professor Cunningham to explain what ways in which it was difficult to uncover as much information as he did for his book. Are there ways in which this shameful history, chapter of our history, has in any way been suppressed or expunged or made difficult to access?
Well, I think it's certainly true that it can be difficult to talk with people about this aspect of the history. So to do interviews and get to people to open up about those experiences, that can be quite difficult for understandable reasons. I think in terms of documents and records that would document what the Klan was doing and some of these less palatable aspects of that era, I think there were a surprising amount of materials available through policing agencies, through the governor's papers in North Carolina. Certainly, there were a number of reporters at the time who were documenting what the KKK was doing, and you could have gone to any of the major newspapers in North Carolina and found literally hundreds of newspaper articles about this. So this certainly wasn't something that was absent from the record previously, but it was something that had been kind of lost in this historical discussion subsequently. So it actually, I found a surprising amount of material about this, but a surprisingly less and little dialogue about people actually engaging with this sort of history. Mm.
We're speaking with David Cunningham and talking about his book, Klansville, USA, The Rise and Fall of the Civil Rights Era Ku Klux Klan, which is also, in a sense, the companion book for this remarkable documentary that airs tonight on PBS for the American Experience series, again, or also called Klansville, USA. Professor Cunningham, without going into extensive detail, I'm afraid, it probably is important for us to just get a general sense of the history of the Ku Klux Klan, exactly when it was formed, and the somewhat benign aspects of it in the early going, which turned much more sinister and ominous as the years progressed. But where did this saga of the Ku Klux Klan begin?
Well, the KKK was first formed in 1866 in Pulaski, Tennessee, and it began very localized within that community. It was formed by a small band of Confederate veterans. Originally, they saw it as doing a range of things, including becoming a fraternal outlet and sort of a way to play pranks on people who they would target, who were often African Americans, but not always. And as you say, over time, certainly in that first era of the Klan was basically commandeered as a way to do much more nefarious things and much more political things. So the quote-unquote pranks that had been the original aim of this group were soon taken over as overt political acts to terrorize political targets, who are, again, most often African Americans. But by 1870, that first wave of the Klan had all but disappeared. And it wasn't until 1915 and peaking in the 1920s that the Klan had had what people often refer to as a rebirth, and that was the era where the Klan was both a national movement and very, very large. It had 4 to 5 million members nationally in all states in the Union.
The documentary, by the way, seems to state that this enormous resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan in the early 20th century can really be laid at the doorstep of this extraordinary silent film, Birth of a Nation. Should we consider that the significant catalyst, or are there other factors which also contributed to the Klan's reemergence in the teens and early 20s?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. The film was certainly a direct impetus for the rebirth of the Klan in the sense that the entrepreneurs that wanted to bring the Klan back into existence used the film, which depicted the Klan as these heroic defenders of the South in the 19th century. They used the film as a basis for reorganizing the Klan. So it really was, in a very strategic sense, used as the vehicle for this direct rebirth. But also during that period, there was a lot of instability and strife around a diversifying country. So there are lots of debates around immigration. There are lots of debates around economic downward mobility. There's a lot of anxiety about people being able to maintain their way of life. So the film was used as a way to bring the Klan back into being, but its appeal really intersected with these broader conditions that were going on throughout the nation.
And, of course, after this resurgence, the Ku Klux Klan once again recedes. More than once in your book, you use the term disarray to describe the state of the Klan. Just what was going on within the organization that, in a sense, prevented it from sort of building on the traction, which it certainly had in a spectacular fashion in the 1920s?
Yes, I mean, the Klan increasingly, as the 20s wore on, was sort of a victim of its own success in some ways. I mean, one of the things that happens when you have a movement of 3 or 4 or 5 million people is that it becomes a vehicle for significant financial gain for its leaders. And so one of the things that happens with the Klan as the 20s wear on are its leaders are caught up in a set of controversies. And you see acts of corruption. You have unlawful behavior beyond the vigilantism that the Klan is known for, but personal issues that really beset leaders and in some cases they're jailed, et cetera. And so some of it is the leaders' mismanagement of the organization. In other cases, the Klan had really grown by appealing in local communities to really presenting themselves as a solution to all sorts of local problems. And over time, they really had to perform as being able to address those kinds of problems, which is much more difficult than saying you're going to address those sorts of problems. So there were, they lost some of their momentum as they really needed to engage with the kinds of issues they said they would engage with. And then the last thing that really matters is that there is a crackdown against Klan violence over time. And you see oftentimes in various periods of Klan activity, including the civil rights era, is that when both local and federal officials take seriously cracking down on the Klan, it can really stamp out their ability to organize.
The film lays out, as does your book, of course, that important court decision in 1954, which seems to strike a death blow against the notion of segregation. Not that the practice of segregation ends overnight, nor is that a struggle that even to this day is, in a sense, completely won. But certainly that was a decision which struck fear and anger in the hearts of many, many Southerners and allowed for the Ku Klux Klan, incited the Ku Klux Klan to this reemergence, this dramatic reemergence. Of course, part of the point of the film is that the place in the South where this took place most dramatically was in North Carolina. Explain to our listeners why it was such a surprise for the Ku Klux Klan to emerge so dramatically in this particular place.
Well, I think most of the acts that the Ku Klux Klan are infamous for during that period, when we think of brutal, whether it be murders or beatings or really serious acts of violence, occurred in the Deep South, in Mississippi and Alabama and Louisiana, to some degree in Georgia. And so most people associate the KKK with those areas because of those acts. But what you see in a place like Mississippi, let's say, is from the governor on down, and a whole set of mainstream officials and institutions who are dedicated to maintaining segregation. And so the Klan in those areas becomes much more contained. They really appeal to a small niche of people who are willing to think that violence is the only answer in terms of preserving segregation. And so the Klan is smaller and more contained in those areas, but also much more staunchly violent. North Carolina was really the opposite situation, where governors and officials in North Carolina were quite clear, even into the 1960s, that they opposed civil rights legislation at the federal level, but they were also clear that they would abide by that sort of legislation and that they would be willing to change and break down Jim Crow segregation if mandated. And so in North Carolina, what Klan leaders were able to do in a way that they couldn't have done in a place like Alabama is say that they're the only group who's willing to stand up for the rights of white citizens in the South to maintain their way of life. And so the Klan in a place like North Carolina has a much broader appeal. It has a sort of an umbrella that captures anyone among the white citizenry who feels like their way of life is threatened.
One statement that is made, I believe, in the film, although perhaps it's someplace in your book as well, is the idea, and I think this is something said about Mr. Bob Jones, who is such a crucial figure in the establishment of the Ku Klux Klan in North Carolina at this point in time, is the fact that he, in some ways, was something of a failure in life, and that perhaps he represented a certain kind of white male in a particular niche below more successful, more demonstrably successful whites, but definitely above blacks, in sort of a middle ground where one might, in a sense, might really feel kind of a tentative hold on your particular place on society's ladder. Tell us more about that sort of middle ground, and if we're talking about those kind of whites that would be drawn to an organization like the Ku Klux Klan.
Sure. Well, in a changing South during the period that was moving certainly away from agriculture, to some degree away from textile mills and things like that, towards a service economy, there is certainly a class of the white citizenry that had the education and skills to take on jobs in a new economy. But among the traditional working class populations all over the South, and certainly in parts of North Carolina, there is what you're describing as this kind of middle ground, where you have white working class citizens who feel like the major piece of security around their way of life, their ability to maintain that way of life, really comes from their racial status. Their ability to hold jobs in part because those jobs are reserved for white workers. So equally skilled African-American workers would not be eligible for holding those kinds of jobs. And so for that slice of the citizenry, certainly the looming end of Jim Crow segregation becomes a very significant threat to what they see as their economic and social well-being. And Bob Jones, as you're saying, really represents that. He sort of represents that aspiration of people who come from those backgrounds and work quite hard to maintain that way of life. And also, he represents the grievances around that the kind of anxieties that people hold around that way of life slipping away in lots of ways. So Jones was one of those people who could really speak to that population and in very compelling ways try to say that the Klan was the solution to those kinds of problems.
One of the things that's really striking in what we hear from Mr. Jones directly in the film, that is from archival film footage of the time, is how unapologetically he talks about all this. throwing the N-word around with absolutely no hesitation whatsoever. And of course, sometimes that's exactly the kind of recorded legacy that we hear from the South of this era. But sometimes we hear people speaking in much more sort of couched language or cautious language, in which there is this sort of veneer of civility, which serves, in some cases at least, as something of a mask that blocks from view perhaps the more barbaric aspects of these attitudes and what this organization in fact represents. Tell us more about the way in which Bob Jones sort of carried himself and presented his case. Was it always in this very sort of unvarnished fashion?
It often was, as you're saying, and people can see this in the film, where he's willing to certainly use language that wouldn't be acceptable today, and at the time would have been seen as fairly extreme. And this unapologetic defense of the Old South and the segregated South as a value that's American, you know, in his view. It's patriotic, it's Christian, it's all of these kinds of things. He certainly is willing and able to be unapologetic about that. He also, though, could be quite disarming, especially in one-on-one kinds of conversations, whether it be with reporters or with, you know, friends or colleagues or small audiences, where, you know, Jones is also somebody who could try to make jokes to kind of disarm things and try to be respectful in certain instances. You know, oftentimes when he'd be asked by, say, reporters whether he's a racist, you know, and the answer to that question is relatively self-evident when you're a Klan Grand Dragon, but he would not use those occasions as a way to launch into a racist diatribe. You know, his stock answer with a laugh would be that, yeah, sure, he's a racist. He spends all of his time racing around North Carolina doing the good work of the KKK. And, you know, so he would use that as a way to kind of shift the conversation from that militance to still an unapologetic defense of what the Klan stood for, but in a way where, at least when he was speaking with white audiences, he could sort of try to disarm people from their expectations of what a Klan leader might say.
By the way, that reminds me, when we read your book, we almost more often than we see the initials KKK, see the initials UKA. UKA. Explain what those initials stand for. It's kind of a striking surprise, actually, in all this.
Yeah, the UKA stands for United Klans of America, and the UKA during that period was the preeminent Klan organization in the South. When the FBI opened their exhaustive investigation of the Klan, they found that there were between 17 and 19 Klan organizations that were active in the South during that period, but the UKA's membership dwarfed that of the rest of the organizations put together. And the way that the UKA was organized, it was based in Alabama in Tuscaloosa, and it was headed up by a guy named Robert Shelton, who lived in Tuscaloosa. But they had what they referred to as state realms, and so every state had its own leadership, and every state was headed up by what people referred to in sort of typical and kind of crazy Klan parlance as headed by Grand Dragons. So Bob Jones was the Grand Dragon of North Carolina. He headed up the what he'd referred to as the Carolina Klan, the state outfit of the UKA.
The fact that you're utilizing that terminology, Grand Dragon and so on, reminds me of something I was anxious to ask you, and that is, can you explain why the Ku Klux Klan adopted the kind of terminology it did and the trappings, the outfits and so on, which to us now, first of all, represent something truly terrible and brutal and evil, and on the other hand, also look a little bit ridiculous and sound a little bit ridiculous. Were they trying to, in a sense, emulate some other kind of organization? And to what extent do you think that was a significant part of the sort of mixed fortunes of the Ku Klux Klan?
Well, the what we think of as very common clan symbolism and regalia and all these things, actually, they were formed, they were a product of the very earliest incarnations of the clan, and they formed largely through folklore that was really popular at the time. So the clan sees itself as a fraternal organization, so it embodies the trappings of fraternal orders and things like that. But what we see is, as the white sheets and the masks and the hoods, that was largely because in the very early days, the Klan saw themselves, in part when they were trying to play these quote-unquote pranks, as being able to go into the countryside, often on horseback, and portray themselves as ghosts or haunted specters as a way to terrorize people. And so the sheets and all were part of that kind of ghostly costume. But then that very quickly gets written into Klan ritual. So you see these very early versions of what the Klan would refer to as their Cloran, which would be their kind of basically guidebook. And it would lay out all their rituals and what people should wear and, you know, the passwords that they would use and the names of the leaders. And so, you know, folklore really informed that. And what we see is from 1966 through the end of, 1866 through the end of that decade, you see a lot of this gets codified and formalized. And the Klan, even though it's receded and grown in waves over the last 150 years at this point, has always been an organization that values its own tradition. So you see a lot of the carry through of these kinds of symbols as we move into the 1920s and into the 1960s and into the Klan today.
Of course, the heart and soul of this documentary story is of how this Klan resurges so dramatically in the 1960s. And we're told numbers that are truly staggering. Explain to our listeners just how powerful the Klan was in North Carolina, particularly in relationship in comparison to the rest of the South.
So North Carolina, by the mid-1960s, had approximately 12,000 dues-paying members, and there were about 23,000 or so dues-paying members in the South altogether. So one way to think about that is that the North Carolina, as its own state, has more dues-paying members than the rest of the South put together. But that, those membership numbers, you know, as you're referencing the kind of staggering growth, really only represent sort of a slice of their support base. Because one of the pretty amazing things about what the Carolina Klan was able to accomplish is that almost every night of the year through the mid-1960s, somewhere in the state, they would hold a nightly rally. And those rallies would attract anywhere between a few hundred to a few thousand people. And in those crowds, you would have a relatively small minority, maybe 100 or 200 of the people in the crowd would be Klan members who would be in robes and in their regalia. And the other hundreds and sometimes thousands of people there would be supporters or spectators or curious onlookers. So, you know, one of the things that we need to pay attention to is the Klan's membership. But the other thing we need to focus on is this much broader support base of people who are willing to come out to these rallies, support the Klan financially, support them morally and politically. So there really was a very broad base around this particular group.
And one interesting observation we see in the documentary is of how many of these Klan rallies would begin in the daylight as something that looked a little like maybe a loosely organized county fair. But as darkness would descend, the tone would grow much more ominous as well, and in a sense the heart and soul of the whole purpose for having such a rally would become much more evident.
That's certainly true, and I often refer to it as a skewed county fair, because exactly how you're saying, you know, people would show up in the late afternoon and there would be music playing. Sometimes they would have a live string band playing. You could buy drinks and refreshments and barbecue, and so, you know, you could go over to basically like a merch table where people would, or Klansmen would be selling brochures and bumper stickers and booklets that the UKA had put out, and there were activities. They would have raffles. They would give things away, and they would have games for the kids. It was really framed as a family event. But exactly as you're saying, as darkness falls, they would have generators so they would be able to light these fields in which these rallies would take place. You would then have usually 2 to 3 hours worth of speakers who would get up and give talks that would, as you might imagine, be quite militant and overtly racist. And so there would be these harangues oftentimes from these speakers for a fairly long period of time. And then the ominous part of the night would kind of climax with a cross burning at the end of the night. And these crosses would be anywhere between 50 and 70 feet high. So these are large crosses, and they would be wrapped in burlap and doused in kerosene and gasoline. And they would literally be lit by torches that Klan members would hold. And so you'd get this burning cross that could be 60 or 70 feet tall. So it was a combination of a spectacle, of kind of a community event in the county fair aspect, but certainly also a militant political event, and one which raised lots of funds for the Klan, too, because they'd be passing around the money buckets throughout all of this to kind of raise resources.
The Klan, of course, declines in significance and numbers very, very quickly, due in large measure, of course, to, in a sense, the misfortune of Bob Jones and a couple of other key leaders of the Carolina Klan. I can sense in much of your book and in this documentary that you have an acute appreciation for how timely this documentary is. That is, although we are talking about events of several decades ago, that there is something very important for us to glean from examining these events.
Certainly. You know, one of the key pieces of the decline of the Klan stems from the murder of Eula Liuzzo, who was a civil rights worker who was killed by the Klan during the Selma to Montgomery march. And so certainly with the very recent release of the film Selma, that really becomes something that people are talking quite a bit about. That sets a lot of things in motion that end up policing the Klan out of existence through the latter half of the 1960s. And more generally, you know, one of the things that I and some of my collaborators have really tried to stress is the tragic and continuing legacy of Klan activity during that period. I mean, one of the things that we've been able to find in a systematic way is that in areas where the Klan was active in the 1960s, those communities continue to have significantly higher rates of violent crime than other communities in the South where the Klan wasn't active. And that's largely because of, you know, the Klan as a vigilante organization really flouts law and order and really says, you know, leave it to us to take care of things. And that really affects the social fabric of communities, and it really delegitimizes authority in a way that really continues to be felt to this day. And we also find in parallel studies how the presence of the Klan in southern communities in the 1960s actually spurs the move across the South for support for Democratic candidates to the now solidly Republican South. And so one of the factors that really moves particular southern communities towards the Republican Party is actually the presence of the Klan in the 1960s.
There is much fascinating information to be found in your book, Klansville, USA, The Rise and Fall of the Civil Rights Era Ku Klux Klan, published by Oxford University Press. The author, Professor David Cunningham, who is also a presence in the documentary film that airs tonight. Professor Cunningham, thank you so much for your good work on this very, very important topic and for writing such a fascinating book.
Thank you for having me.
You are listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music on your gateway to public radio. And now I'm truly honored to speak with the director and producer of this superb documentary, Klansville, USA, airing tonight on PBS's American Experience on Channel 10 in Milwaukee and on PBS stations across the country. Callie Weiser is responsible for a number of fine films that perhaps you have seen on television, including The Amish and The Amish Shunned on American Experience. She also worked on the very highly acclaimed documentary about George H.W. Bush, and was also part of the production team for God in America. Again, her film Clansville, USA is airing tonight. And Callie Weiser, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me.
It's a superb film. I want to ask you one question, which I also pose to Professor Cunningham, who is one of your expert guests and wrote a book also called Clansville, USA. I asked him if, as he did research on this topic, if he had any sense that this really uncomfortable, distasteful chapter in our own history has to any extent been sort of expunged or whitewashed or wiped away even. I should think that would be a fear for someone like you, for instance, trying to create a documentary about this era. It turns out, from what we can tell, that there's all kinds of things that are available. I mean, it's not that anybody set about burning films in shame for fear that, you know, someday people would look with fear or disgust on what occurred. It seems as though that history, that legacy, was there for the taking for you and your crew. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, I think we were surprised by how much archive we found, how much video existed from, or film existed from, the time period, from these rallies, everyday events, the street walks. Those type of things, we were really impressed with the amount of archive that our archivist was able to dig up. And it wasn't all just sitting there. You know, a lot of it was mislabeled, or they weren't sure they had it, or they had to retransfer it from film. It had never been seen before. So we were very excited by that. But I also think that what struck me about some of that archive is that we look back now and we think, oh, well, gosh, these people agreed to be on camera. You know, they allowed these cameras to come in to these events, and we think of it as shameful. But at the time, they didn't think of it as shameful. You know, they thought of it as a gathering, and they felt like that in their minds they were doing the same things as civil rights workers were doing. They were demonstrating. They were letting their voice be heard, and that's how they saw it at the time. So it's not that surprising, even though it's surprising and shocking to see some of it, and I'm still in shock to see some of it. You know, if you think about it, at the time, they didn't feel like they were doing much wrong.
Right. And so, in a sense, it's not that hidden cameras were even required. I mean, they were happy to get the story out, particularly in North Carolina, which was trying to present, in a sense, a slightly more civilized face to the name and legacy of the Ku Klux Klan.
Exactly. And one of the photographers, when our archivist, Liz Shea, called him up, he answered the phone. He said, "I've been waiting for 20 years for this call." He said, "I've got some of these images sitting under my bed, literally still under my bed, because it meant so much to him at the time to be there." And he felt like there it was no way that someone was never going to do this story. And a lot of people think it's a fresh story and a new story, but for a lot of people, it's been there all along. It's just been waiting to be told.
Wow. Remind us again, who were you just now talking about?
One of the photographers.
At the time, you mean?
Yes.
A photographer in that era, at that time
and place. Yeah, his name was Bruce Roberts.
Hmm. Wow.
Yeah, and he had saved these images, and, you know, he has various archives. You know, he has some in Texas, and, you know, he has photos different places, but he also had some at his house, and it just meant so much to him to be there. And he would say, you know, you could never hide a camera back in those days.
Right.
That's you know, they had huge flash bulbs and things like that. But, you know, the press was invited to these things. That started to change a little bit later on when the Klan started to get more of a when they started to get more nervous about the FBI, when they started to think that some of the photographers were there spying on them from the FBI and HUAC. They started to limit the press more, but at the beginning, you know, they wanted exposure.
Yeah.
And they wanted to be out there.
Speaking of photography, I have to say that one of the most, although there's all kinds of amazing film footage from the era, I have to say that one of the most striking moments in the whole film is actually a still photograph of an outdoor rally. It is at the time, I think, when you are talking about the very able chaplain of the North Carolina Klan. I believe that was George Dorsett. But as you are talking about him and what a fine speaker he was, we're shown this photograph in brilliant color. Mm-hmm. And there's something about that picture and the fact that it is in color and so crystal clear. I wonder if you remember the picture I'm talking about. It's kind of taken from above.
Absolutely.
And suddenly the Ku Klux Klan does not seem like something from our distant past, but it makes it seem like this was yesterday. And in the grand scheme of things, this was just yesterday.
It's true, and I think that that still is one that really captured the imagination of the executive producer of American Experience, Mark Sammels, and that was one that stuck in his mind, of a surprising image. And, you know, in the other stills, we have more stills from that event, and you can see actually the photographers up on the hill behind George Dorsett who took that picture, looking down on this crowd. And the fact it's in color, I'm glad you caught that, because very often when you want to keep a scene together, you want to do it all in black and white or all in color with whatever you have. But that one, we couldn't. The rest of them had been in black and white, and that's how they were natively, and we couldn't not have that one in a brilliant color.
Oh, I'm so glad you did that, because again, it gives it a sense of immediacy and a sense that this just happened. This is these are very recent events in our collective history.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point, and one that, to me, you know, I grew up after the civil rights movement. I grew up after the 60s, and one of the women I spoke to, an African-American woman, when I was doing background research, said that her son said to her, well, no one could ever tell me where I would eat and where I wouldn't eat. And she said, oh, yes, sir, they most surely would, and you would have eaten where they told you you could eat and couldn't eat. And I think for a lot of people, it seems like such a distant past, but when you start getting in the actual dates and you start looking at the history, it's not very long ago at all. And what made me want to get into the film was actually I was started thinking about this right after seeing a film about Obama, a documentary on Frontline about Obama. And, you know, they, in Frontline fashion, they had put together all these people talking about post-racial, how we'd all moved on. And then you see these signs of people, there were blatantly racist signs held up against Obama. And that got me thinking, you know, there's this wish we all collectively want to have moved on. And in some ways, we wish ourselves to have moved on so far. And yet, you know, wishing for it and making it happen aren't the same thing, and you have to talk about it to make it happen.
Absolutely.
So I was hoping this film would create a dialogue.
I'm sure it will. A couple other things I want to make sure I have time to ask you about. Mm-hmm. This, we would not understand the story of the rise of the Ku Klux Klan in North Carolina if you didn't, we wouldn't understand it as well as we do through your film if your film didn't also do a really good job of painting a picture of how most people thought of North Carolina in this era, and it was admittedly probably one of the more progressively minded states of the South. But I think one of the best choices you make is to show us a few little excerpts from the Andy Griffith Show, set in the mythical small town of Mayberry, North Carolina. And it's really quite striking the way this is utilized. And then the fact that mention is made of the occasional black face that one will see in the crowd in the background. And I'd never stopped to think of that before, even for all the many, many times I've watched and enjoyed that show. In my mind's eye, I don't ever remember there ever being a black person in Mayberry, but there is. We see it on the screen, but only in the background, essentially never speaking. Can you say a word more about why you thought it was important and effective to include this in your film?
Well, I think that, you know, I think that Americans want to see themselves a certain type of thing. And the Andy Griffith Show is a show that people watched. And by 1968, when the political assassinations were going on, that was the number one rated show. And why was it? It was because it was of a time that people felt like was slipping away, a peaceful time when everything could be resolved peacefully. And yet, when you look at it, there are a handful of blacks in the show. There's only one in the entire series of the show that has a speaking role, and that's not until Andy Griffith is in color, and he is a football coach. And so I think that, you know, looking at this, it just made me think about how we view ourselves and how we want to view ourselves and how sometimes just ignoring race and racial strife altogether is the easiest thing to do.
Your documentary includes, as we've already touched on, remarkable footage of the Ku Klux Klan in action. And I think one of the most striking sequences is when we are taken, in a sense, to one of these Ku Klux Klan rallies, which in the daylight were sort of bright, happy, all family, something for the whole family kinds of events. And as night would descend, the tenor of them would really, really change dramatically. Tell us, I'm sure you culled through all kinds of potential footage. What sorts of things you thought about as you chose the film that we do end up seeing in your film? What were you most anxious to show to us, the viewer?
Well, I wanted to try and get across what people felt like at the time. And one of the things that was really important to me, even though we weren't able, Bob Jones passed away, George Dorsett passed away, these people weren't alive to tell us their stories or their angle on these stories. But what I really wanted to do was I wanted to show that feeling that people had of the county fair. And what's interesting is that a lot of the photographers, the film that existed, most film crews didn't go until it was starting to get dark. They didn't film when it was the daytime because that's actually probably boring. And, film is expensive. Now we have video cameras and people go out and shoot whatever they want. But film is expensive, so they would save it for the big event, the Burning Cross. So I wanted to try and make sure that we could show the other side that people kept talking about. People kept talking about going in the afternoon and feeling like this was a family event. During the summer, what they called rally season, people would travel around, and it was like what they did for their summer vacation. They would see everybody, their extended families, as they referred to them. And so I wanted to be able to show that. And so we were lucky to get a lot of those stills that I think really exhibit that and show what people felt like it was really like.
Absolutely. And I think one of the most striking moments is when we hear, first of all, from the wife of Bob Jones, who would speak at some of these rallies, specifically targeting some of the women in the crowd and calling them to action. But then we hear from this extraordinary speaker by the name of George Dorsett, who the sort of the chaplain of the group. And in the excerpt which you choose to air on this documentary, we hear him in his remarks echoing, but only for the sake of savaging, the I Have a Dream speech given by Martin Luther King Jr. I should think that just about any American would just shudder to hear somebody speaking in this way and, in a sense, twisting those words which we all remember so vividly.
Yes, and I think that for me, it's hearing that twist, because I do think that there's this want to have this either be an evil group or a good group. They would always talk about how they would go out and raise money if someone was burned out, whether they were black or white. If they were burned out from their house, the Klan would raise money for them. But then they would also have these moments of such hatred and such vitriol and using the Bible. But that's how they understood the Bible. But they would use the Bible and use religion to justify their cause. And I think that in reality, it's both those things. It's not just good or evil. I couldn't ever argue that it was just good. But you know what I'm saying? There's this want to make something easily definable. And what we wanted to show was that it's much more complex. And yes, and there are kids there. I hope that people see that there are children in the audience. And people, Patsy Sims, who's in the film, told me that she went to a lot of Klan rallies researching for a book she wrote called The Klan. And she was at first appalled by these children being there. She was so amazed that parents would bring their children this. But then she realized that these people actually believe this. And this was simply something they saw as a rite of passage and something they saw as completely not dangerous.
Hmm. Another incredible moment in the film is when we see grainy footage of an initiation ceremony for the Ku Klux Klan. And what is especially intriguing is that we hear directly from one of those men many, many years later. I don't know if that was an interview you did for the sake of the documentary or an interview that occurred at some other time, but we are hearing from one of those men looking back many years at the moment when he was initiated. And it is so interesting to hear from him what it felt like for him to be part of this organization and why it was something he felt like he needed to do.
Yes, and I think that is something that is hugely important in understanding how these groups arise. Because, his was about race, but that wasn't the primary motivator for him joining the Klan. And I think that's really important to keep in mind. It transcends race, this left-behindness or this feeling of being left out of your own country. And that's something that, if you focus just on race, then you're going to miss the fact that now the Klan, and the Klan is nothing compared to what it was then, but now, you see the Klan perking up again in different areas. People write about how they're leaving, candy on people's driveways and flyers, and that's about immigration. It's about the same idea of being left behind in your own country. And that gentleman, we did not do that interview for this film. He has passed away since, but he was somebody who I just felt like was the everyman. And when I talk to people at, you know, we go have dinner somewhere and I tell people what I was working on, they say, oh, my uncle, you know, oh, he went to Klan rallies. You know, they never seemed that bad to him, you know, but he went, you know, he didn't have much else going on. And, you know, you don't want to, I never wanted to whitewash the Klan, but I wanted to understand that aspect, because if you don't understand that part of it, then you're going to have a hard time ever trying to get people to move on from it.
Absolutely.
If you don't accept that there was something other than race going on.
Right. And the fact that so much of what sparked this was fear, and mm-hmm. also this sense that they were losing an already sort of precarious place in the American landscape. And I think you're right. It helps us understand what they were going through, even if we reject with all the fiber of our being the way in which they went about trying to act on their fears.
Exactly. Exactly.
As you look at this film in its completed state, I should think you feel a huge amount of relief, because it is no small matter to try to tell a story as complex as this and in a way that shows it honestly and frankly without demonizing anyone or anything, at least more than is necessary. Do you feel good about the choices which you ultimately made as a filmmaker?
I do. I think that you're right. I do think that there is, it's the understanding, even though you may not agree. And I think that's something that is a very hard balance to try and present. Because to hear people who had been in the Klan, and the reason the Klan still has some power with people, is because they are still able to say, we have been misunderstood. No one understands us. They only talk about the race stuff. And as long as you give someone that power to say we've never been understood, then they have that over the people who might follow them. You know, you feel misunderstood, well, you know, come on in, we've never been understood. We've been this good organization. We've done these wonderful things for people. And that's power that they have, because no one has cared to understand them.
Hmm. Well, we can understand them a bit better, at least, after watching your very, very fine film, Klansville, USA, which airs tonight for the PBS series American Experience. And the director and producer of it, Callie Weiser. Callie Weiser, I congratulate you on a truly superlative film, and I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Professor Art Sear from Carthage College joins us for his monthly visit to the program, his first visit in 2015, offering his analysis of current events. On Thursday, the monthly visit of the United Environmental Council. And on Friday, I reconnect with Mark Cushman to talk about the third in his series of three books about Star Trek, the original series. His books are called These Are the Voyages, and take a painstaking look at the series as it was produced episode by episode. We look at the way in which the third and final season of the original Star Trek series unfolded, that interview airing on Friday's morning show. WGTD is supported by Carthage College. Dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Support also comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, a proud supporter of WGTD's Morning Show. Partly cloudy skies today with a high temperature of 17 degrees, partly cloudy overnight, and our low drops to -1. Tomorrow, Wednesday, should be a cloudy day, even cloudier than today, with a high of 20, but it sparks a warming trend. Thursday, partly sunny, high of 29. By Friday, mostly sunny, a high of 33 degrees, and we should see the upper 30s for high temperatures by the weekend. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and